once more with feeling. Thanks everyone for coming today to the Charter Group. A couple of weeks ago we did our first class where we did a general overall survey of the Jatakas, what they are, where they fit into Buddhist literature, how they're constructed, and so on and so forth. And so for today's class, I want to get on to the actual main theme that I was wanted to illustrate from these classes, and which I have found some interesting stuff in various Jataka stories. So here is a table. The irrational longings of women. Alright, so this is going to be the theme for the next few weeks. Alright, so this is a table. This is, if you remember last time, I was struggling to display this table, and this is the reconstructed version. Now this is a series of tales found in the Jatakas. Now this table is the versions of this particular structure or type or archetype of tale. Now I've selected, there's about 16 there, although as you can see some of them overlap, the equivalent signs. Okay, so they're ones which are more or less the same, different versions. And a couple of them have intro next to it. That means that the part that we're interested in occurs in the introductory section, not in the actual Jataka itself, but in the story of this life. All right. Of course, there's many others which more or less approximately could be considered under the same category, but these are the ones which are most specifically followed what seems to me to be this quite important archetypal pattern. And I haven't included here a broader survey of the Buddhist literature and Jatakas outside of the Pali collection. This is only the Pali Jatakas. So I'll just run very briefly. We'll refer back to this table as we go through, but I just want to just briefly have a look at this and just give you an idea of the kind of things. And what this is showing you is the similarities and differences between the different tales which I've chosen to include under this categorization. I haven't actually checked yet, it's something that's on my to-do list, but there's actually a kind of a more or less official, very complex categorization scheme for all folk tales. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that. There's an international classification scheme for folk tales, and basically any kind of folk tale or story or song is in one or other of those categories. It was developed during by the folklore studies in the 20th century. So I haven't yet had a look at that, but I'm sure we'll find that these stories fit in there somewhere. Okay, so just to say, the different headings here, the type of story, high, low, or medium. Okay, so this is just a general classification, as we'll see that the low versions of the story talk about things like jackals and crocodiles and so on, whereas the high versions are like kings and queens engaged in mythic quests for golden or mythical animals and so on. So it's pitched at different levels, but the same story, the same underlying pattern of story pitched at very different levels. Second column, Dohala, is a Pali word which is I had never encountered before. It's actually derived from Durhareya, which means bad heart or sad heart. And it's a particular word which is used only in this context, and I haven't been able to find it used in any other context, and it means only the insatiable and unstoppable desire of a woman. It's sometimes used in the context of the cravings of pregnancy, but most of the time not. Okay, so it's a very interesting term that it occurs only in this particular context. And the question is the character, the female character, does she threaten to die? Okay, so usually in these stories the female lead character basically lies down and says she's going to stay here until she dies, okay, unless she gets what she wants. And the circumstances in which the thing occurs, and as you, which the event occurs where her desire is provoked or springs up, and as you can see, very often It's at a time of dreaming or lying down or being asleep. Occasionally at the time of conception, it appears. And occasionally also when one is ill. So again, this has a significance. And one of the things that I'm going to be doing, obviously, is to draw parallels between these stories and various psychological interpretations of myth and fairy tales, especially Jungian interpretation. And of course, the Jungian interpretation argues that there's a very strong parallel between what we dream and what we read about in fairy tales. Now, we don't find that explicitly stated in Buddhist literature, but it is, I think, very noteworthy that many of these, in fact, do occur in a dream. So that connection has been made in the stories themselves. Oh, one point I should have made earlier, here on the type of the high-low medium, you see most of them are of a high type. Okay, we'll see more what that means later on. But that also, to me, that suggests that the main purpose or the main focus of this is actually quite a spiritual tale. Okay, it's not just a worldly fable. Okay, so this here now we have a list of the things that she wants: a golden peacock, the heart of a monkey. This one is an interesting, the inner mango. Okay, and so one of the questions of the story, of course, is exactly what is the inner mango, right? The king, the food of the king. So this is a crow queen who wants the king's food, mangoes, king's blood, monkey's heart, the red fish, a ritual bathing. Golden deers, golden peacocks, golden gooses, a six-tusked, magnificent royal white elephant, and the heart of a sage. And so these different kind of things that she's aspiring towards. And who is the woman who wants all these things? In most cases, you can see it's Queen Kema. Okay, and we'll come back to that later on when we look at these particular stories. Often sometimes it's just an animal, a crocodile or jackal or something. Sometimes the queen of the crows. One or two cases, it's a low caste woman, Chandala, and so on. And also can be a Naga as well, Vimala, the queen of the Nagas. Okay, and what's she after? Right, what does she actually want? And in some cases, she wants Dhamma, she wants the truth or immortality. Sometimes she's just after taste, she wants to enjoy the flavour. Sometimes she's after a son. Yeah. Sometimes she wants to perform a ritual. Okay, so these different meanings, sometimes vengeance. So you can see that when I've categorized these as high, low and medium, I've taken these different things into account in giving that rough categorization. So obviously kind of vengeance is a very low kind of aim, whereas wanting Dhamma is a high aim. So one of the things that this tells us is that the story is not at its base an ethical story. Okay, even though it's phrased in an ethical way, the same pattern of story can be used in an ethical sense or in an unethical sense. Okay, and that tells us that it's a more fundamental truth. It's not just telling us this is right, this is wrong, do this, don't do that. It's not just a moral fable. Of course, it performs that role as well, but it also performs a much deeper function. Okay, so then the question, does she succeed or not? And in some cases she does, many cases she succeeds in her wish, in some cases she doesn't, and some cases she gets something which she didn't quite expect. So, for example, in this one, her husband becomes the king of the night. Okay, and we'll see more what that means later on. And in some she gets what she wants, but she dies heartbroken anyway. Okay. In that case, she was motivated by cruelty. Sometimes she'll succeed, sometimes she won't. And finally, the means of attaining what she wishes for. In some cases, compassion. In some cases, a trick. So, in some cases, just patience, heroism, honesty, a trick. And in the higher forms of the myth, it's by compassion that one attains what one needs.
So are these all, these 16 or so stories, yep, are they all the stories for women in this list?
Just this particular pattern of story, which we'll have a look at in more detail in just a minute. Okay. Of course, there's many, of course, many other stories about women in the Jatakas, which many of which are also very entertaining. But this is just the ones that represent this particular pattern. But now the thing that struck me as interesting when I started noticing these stories and started reading them is because, you know, this idea of the irrational longings of women, I mean, this is something which is a staple of misogynistic discourse. You know, women are just full of desires, they're irrational, you can't understand them, and all of these kinds of things. And it's something which can be and often is depicted in a very negative way within Buddhist discourse as within other forms of patriarchal discourse. And so when you see a motif of a woman who wants something, then there's almost like a predisposition to see this in very kind of negative and stereotype terms. But what I started to notice when I was reading these stories was that in some cases those stereotypes seemed to be reinforced. In other cases they were questioned, and in other cases they clearly resulted in something which was quite unexpected and quite different from what the stereotype might lead you to believe. And so I think one of the things then that became very interesting for me to understand was how the deeper, the more profound truths which are embodied in these kinds of mythological literature get filtered through various personal layers depending on the biases and prejudices of the storytellers. And they can be presented as if they appear in one way or another. But actually there's also... I don't want to denigrate or belittle the importance of the surface appearance of stories, because when stories are presented as if they are misogynistic, they are taken in that way and they're used in that way and they have genuine effects. So I'm not trying to argue that those misogynistic surfaces or sexist surfaces are unreal or untrue or unimportant. But what I am trying to say is that there is another layer to these which can emerge a different kind of truth. Okay, I'm not saying that one is better than the other or more important. I'm just saying that they can be seen in these different ways. And I'm, you know, for myself, I'm just more interested in the things that are subtle and less obvious. That's why I tend to focus on them. Okay, so that's any more questions on this before we go on to read a couple of stories? I realise this is all very vague and abstract so far. Hopefully it'll become a bit more concrete as we do some reading. Okay. I did do that. It's very pretty, isn't it? That's why I was so disappointed last time when it all disappeared. Alright, so what I'll do is I'll start with some of the lower forms of the myth, and we can read a few of them, and I intend to read through most of these stories over the next three lessons, okay? And we'll do some of the lower forms to start with, and then gradually see how we go, getting to the more higher forms. So this is the first one I'm going to read is from the story of the monkey and the crocodile, the Jataka number 208, which is very similar to Jataka 342. Okie dokie. So the background story to this particular Jataka, and I'll just pull up the text of it here. Actually, I don't want to pay too much attention to the Pali text of these things. It's not. It's more just the telling of the story that's important, not the actual vocabulary. Anyway, here's the Pali text. Anyone who's interested. This is a story the Buddha told at Jetavana about Devadatta's attempts to murder him. Okay. When he heard of these attempts, the master said, "This is not the first time that Devadatta had tried to murder me. He did the same before, and yet could not so much as make me afraid." Okay. Now, of course, this is very standard, and usually the default position of the Jataka stories is whenever you've got a bad guy, then make it into Devadatta. Okay. And here's the story. Once upon a time, while Brahmadatta was the king of Benares, the Bodhisattva came to life at the foot of the Himalaya as a monkey. He grew strong and sturdy, big of frame, well-to-do, and lived by a curve of the river Ganges in a forest haunt. Now at that time there was a crocodile dwelling in the Ganges. The crocodile's mate saw the great frame of the monkey, and she conceived a longing for his heart to eat. So she said to her husband, I desire to eat the heart of that great king of the monkeys. Good wife, said the crocodile, I live in the water, and he lives on dry land. How shall we catch him? She replied, by hook or by crook. By hook or by crook. Oh, yena kenachi upayena. Oh, that's interesting. The translator said by hook or by crook. And the Pali is by whatever upaya you can. Okay, so whatever skillful means you can. So this is how upaya is used. Yeah. Yena kenachi upana yena gunha. Yeah, it's quite well captured in the English there. I quite like these translations. By hook or by crook. Okay. Caught he must be. If I don't get him, I will die. Na labhisami marisami. Okay? If I don't get it, I will die. Alright? So here you have it all in the essence, right? I mean, it's all there. It's all very straightforward. No sense of reasoning or arguing or discussion or anything like that. That's what I want. If I don't get it, I'm going to die. Right. Okay, so. All right, said the crocodile, consoling her. Don't trouble yourself. I have a plan. I will give you his heart to eat. So, when the bodhisattva was sitting on the bank of the Ganges, after taking a drink of water, the crocodile drew near and said, good monkey, why do you live on bad fruits in this old familiar place? On the other side of the Ganges, there is no end to the mango trees and the labuja trees, whatever they are, and with fruit as sweet as honey. Is it not better to cross over and have all kinds of wild fruit to eat? But crocodile, said the monkey, deep and wide is the river Ganges. How shall I get across? But I said, if you will go, I will mount you on my back and carry you over. The monkey trusted him and agreed, come here then, up on my back with you. And up the monkey climbed. But when the crocodile had swum a little way, he plunged the monkey under the water. Good friends, you're letting me sink, cried the monkey. What is that for? The crocodile said, you think I'm carrying you out of goodwill? Not a bit of it. My wife has a longing for your heart, and I want to give it to her to eat. Friend, said the monkey, it's nice of you to tell me, but if that my heart was inside of me when I go jumping around the treetops, it would be all knocked to pieces. Well, said the crocodile, where do you keep it? The bodhisattva pointed out a fig tree with clusters of ripe fruits standing not far off. See? See over there where our hearts are hanging on the fig tree? If you show me your heart, said the crocodile, then I won't kill you. Take me to the tree then and I'll point it out to you hanging upon it. The crocodile brought him to the place. The monkey leapt off his back and climbing up the fig tree sat upon it and cried out, you silly crocodile! You thought that there were creatures that kept their hearts in a treetop. You are a fool, and I have outwitted you. You may keep your fruit to yourself. Your body is great, but your brain is small. And then to explain this, he uttered the following verses. Rose apple, jackfruit, and mangoes too across the water there I see. Enough of them, I don't want them. My fig is good enough for me. Great is your body, but how much smaller is your wit? Now go your ways, good crocodile, for I've had the best of it. The crocodile, feeling as sad and miserable as if he'd lost 1,000 pieces of money, went back sorrowing to the place where he lived. And, of course, had to face his missus. When the master had ended this discourse, he identified the birth. In those days, Devadatta was the crocodile. The ascetic, the female ascetic, Chincha, was his mate. And I was the monkey. So if you remember, Chincha was the one who falsely accused the Buddha of raping her, or having his way with her anyway. So that's the story of the crocodile, two crocodiles and the monkey. So what does that tell us? Nana foolish. Because?
They're just giving you the wind, the unreasonable
whims
of his wife.
Okay, so it's man's foolish for giving in to the irrational whims of his wife. Okay. What other lessons have we learned?
friendship between you and the monkey is really just a crisis term for a very big desire level. Maybe it's because of his strong love for her.
Yeah.
How is this story from the man?
Because? Because why is it written by a man?
Why?
Yeah.
Because things that women
History is, that's true. But this isn't history, this is a folk tale, and very often folk tales are passed down among women as well. And the collection was certainly made by men, no doubt about that. But
yeah,
the tale.
The ones that were chosen to be kept. And,
yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah, but I want to hear a specific reason why this tale was told by a man.
Because it describes the woman, the female crocodile. So it's just an irrational element, part of the monkey, whatever the world is. I'm too much of a view.
It sounds a great villain and too powerful. It's interesting though that although it's about a woman in a way, I don't understand about women, she doesn't actually have that much. And she doesn't have focus in that whole story. It's just an almost an external sort of inference, a given. It's not actually about the woman or why she wants it or her struggle or her, what her life looks like. It's then actually about what kind of men and the wit and that payoff between the wit and, well, the brain and the brawn.
But
not really about.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting feature which we'll see in all of these. Yeah. But remember, she's the creator. Yeah. If she hadn't had her wish, the whole story wouldn't have happened.
Assuming, if we do assume, and let's do it, that this is written by men, then what it shows is on a number of different levels, not just the irrational desires of women, but also on many different levels the foolishness of men. And the men who, if we do assume that they wrote it, are so foolish that they don't even realise that they're doing it. So the first thing is that actually in this entire story, the most powerful character, even though she's not talked about at all, is the female. The second thing is that it's just a story of folly of men. So while the men is assumed, it's trying to tell a story about the greatness of men, that is the greatness of the male Buddha, is actually telling a story about the great folly of this interaction between two men in the first place. And then also subverting itself by its own foolishness, by saying that actually the woman is the most powerful character.
I think, so just to come to the question of authorship, one thing to remember, of course, is that, you know, we have many, many versions of this story, even within the Jatakas. They're not written by one person. They're handed down from hand to hand. And so they've been inside the consciousness of both men and women. Yeah? No doubt about that. But now who, of course, as the Pali Jataka collection, the final hand in the redaction was obviously the hand of the monks, there's no doubt about that. But in terms of the history that that story's come to be, it's a collective history, not an individual one.
Here the story sort of reminds me of the emperors of the Chinese dynasties who are always just like falling into the trap of women sent by uncles of another country for their downfall.
Mm-hmm.
And it only shows that men are so weak when it comes to women.
Mm.
I mean, there are so many historical records of kings, you know, who are so strong, who want to defeat the other country. And the only way to stop them is for this weaker country to send a very beautiful and wise woman to become their conqueror. And they just have a king, how to say, spun around their little finger.
Mm.
Yeah, to the extent of even causing the son and father to kill each other or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just talking about men's weakness.
Mm.
When it comes to the power of women's charms and
mm-hmm.
and people, or cruelty, or whatever you call it.
And in this story, what's interesting is that, say, the Bodhisattva, he has a directional desire. He wants to go to the other side to get some fruit. And he's so easily tricked by the crocodile.
Yeah.
And while the two men are going through all this effort to fulfill their own rational wishes, there's the woman in the background sitting around him.
Yeah, well, then, yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, like, when there's someone, you know, what's at the end of the day, what are they left with? You know, how did this experience kind of change what they had before? And I want to think they're all worse off.
Yeah.
The woman is worse off. She had this irrational whim but didn't get what she wanted.
Yeah.
So she might have been the most powerful character, but how did she use her power to create what?
Yeah.
And the men are also worse off because their friendship is destroyed. So in a way, it's almost how the two genders kept each other in a position of weakness, I would say, and rather than a sense of seeing each other perhaps as strong as they could and bringing certain characteristics or strengths to the combination, and therefore elevating everyone to a higher level.
Yeah.
Sort of that just seems to fall lower.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the power the woman holds. And to Peter in lots of, as I said, in a lot of stories across all cultures, it's a sexual power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if women don't choose to exercise that, then perhaps they have no power.
I mean, that could be inferred from here, although it's not so explicitly mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But is there sexual power? I think the wisdom of it. I don't know what to call the wisdom of it. They have to be so. they have to be so skinny.
Upaya.
Yeah. To me, it's kind of capability on the woman's part.
Well, if they choose not to exercise that, or if that isn't in their nature, then they are powerless.
Except in the story.
Except in the story, which, as I think, is written by me.
Well, it's not to say that stories have not always been the most powerful weapons, but.
Have the effect of this
of the address. The spirit stories that capture people's imagination, that spread like wildfire, that speak in people's minds,
mm-hmm.
are more powerful than sort of the dominant group of system that can have its own power.
And you see that a lot in the Jataka stories. Like, there's a lot of Jatakas that are very critical of the kings and all of these kinds of things, you know, and the kings that made a laughing stock again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give.
Sure.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, the nature of desire, isn't it? Yeah.
But it's not that you will die.
Maybe not, yeah.
Well,
it would seem to be fairly you know, very immature emotional expression.
Yeah.
But those things often, if they're taken back to a more primitive or more basic level, might actually be the case. But in any case, whether it would have literally been the case or not, the point here is that's the storytelling device.
Yes.
That's the motive power for the storytelling. Yeah?
But when it was created, the story, I mean, I've somebody made up a story like that now, about teenage girls,
yeah,
wants and desires, or boys for that matter.
Yeah.
Then said, it's not going to take it.
Yeah.
And then that became, and then you dissipated, you know, that's just something that you've done,
yeah,
that's just common to the union.
Yeah.
And then if that was taken into another century where that wasn't the common union, then people say, oh, I've got a little diver that doesn't get their hand back.
Yeah.
And you might interpret it in a different way.
Of course, yeah. So let's see if any of the other versions, anyone does actually die. Maybe they might actually follow through. I just wanted to read, this is another variant which the translator here gives as a footnote. And because, as I said, you know, the folklorists collect these things and classify them and so on, and here he just gives as a footnote a variant which was told to him by a certain Mr. I. Nestor Schnurman, who, that's actually how I think it's supposed to be pronounced, Schnurman, who heard it from his nurse around 1860. All right? So here we've got a direct link back to the female oral storytelling tradition in 1860. This is the European translator. This is in Russia. This is a Russian version from Moscow. Okay, once upon a time, the king of the fishes was wanting in wisdom. His advisors told him that once he could get the heart of the fox, he would become wise. So he sent a deputation consisting of the great magnates of the sea, whales, and others. Our king wants your advice on some state affairs. The fox, flattered, consented. A whale took him on his back. On the way, the waves beat upon him, and at last he asked what they really wanted. They said, what our king really wanted was to eat the heart of the fox, by which he hoped to become clever. The fox said, well, why didn't you tell me that? I would gladly sacrifice my life for such a worthy object, but we foxes always leave our hearts at home. Take me back and I'll fetch it. Otherwise, I'm sure your king will be very angry. So they took him back. As soon as he got near the shore, he leapt on land and cried, you idiots, have you ever heard of an animal that doesn't carry his heart with him? And he ran off. The fish had to return empty-handed. So obviously a very close parallel there. The clever fox instead of the clever monkey. And basically exactly the same thing. But the new motif which is introduced there is that by getting the heart, they become wise. There's no woman in that one, yeah. That suggests, perhaps, a question that we haven't answered, we haven't raised so far. Why does she want the heart of the monkey? Yeah? Tava haraya mangse. Right? That's what she wants, the heart, the flesh of the heart. Why does she want the flesh of the heart? Yeah? So there's clearly an evolutionary perspective happening here. The crocodile is the lower form. It's immersed in the water. Yeah? Like the unconscious, the monkey is up, is in the air, in the trees, and the monkey is the one who has the brain and the clever, the trickster, clever at trickery, compared to the crocodile. And so this motif what they're actually after is the intelligence or the wisdom, might seem to have a certain plausibility. But we can just leave that suggestion now. That's something which comes up again in some of the other versions of the story, so we can leave that. But what I'd just like to raise now, my favourite book, Golden Bough, the external soul. The question here that's raised, have you ever heard of an animal that doesn't carry his heart with him? And he ran off. Now this is a major theme in Fraser's The Golden Bough, where he talks about this motif or this folk belief that the soul can be kept somehow outside of the body. And I'll just read a few examples of this, just to give you some idea of what's been going on about. There's so many of these stories, I'm just trying to think which ones to read. Okay, so here's what he calls a Hindu story. So these are collected from all around the world. This one happens to be an Indian one. tells how a magician called Punchkin held a queen captive for 12 years and would want to marry her, but she would not have him. At last, the queen's son came to rescue her, and the two plotted together to kill Punchkin. So the queen spoke kindly to the magician and pretended that she had at last made up her mind to marry him. "And do tell me," she said, "are you quite immortal? Can death never touch you? And are you too great an enchanter ever to feel human suffering?" "It is true," he said, "that I am not as others. Far, far away, hundreds of thousands of miles from this, there lies a desolate country covered with a thick jungle. In the midst of the jungle grows a circle of palm trees, and in the centre of the circle stands 6, what are called chatties, must be 6 pots or something, full of water, piled one on top of another. Below the 6th chatty is a small cage, which contains a little green parrot. On the life of the parrot depends my life, and if the parrot is killed, I must die. It is, however, impossible that the parrot should sustain any injury, because the country is inaccessible, and because I've appointed many thousands of yakas to guard the palm trees, and they kill everyone who approaches. But the queen's young son, of course, overcame all difficulties and got possession of the parrot. He brought it back to the door of the magician's palace and began playing with it. Punchkin, the magician, saw him, and coming out, tried to persuade the boy to give him the parrot. "Give me my parrot," he cried. Then the boy took hold of the parrot and tore off one of his wings. As he did so, the magician's right arm fell off. He then stretched out his left arm, crying, "Give me my parrot." The prince pulled off the parrot's second wing, and the magician's left arm tumbled off. So the magician then cried, "It's just a flesh wound." "And give me my parrot." And he fell to his knees. The prince pulled off the parrot's right leg. The right leg fell off. He pulled off the left leg, and the left leg fell off. Nothing remained of him except the trunk and the head. But still he rolled his eyes and said, "Give me my parrot." "Take your parrot," cried the boy. And with that he wrung the bird's neck and threw it at the magician. And as he did so, Punchkin's head twisted round, and with a fearful groan, he died. Okay, so that's a very common archetype of the story. Same thing found all through Asia, through Greece, and many different versions of the same one, which you can all read about in here. But just another, rather than reading lots of variants of that particular one, there's also many tales of the external soul in folk custom. So, for example, the people of Minahassa in Celebes, not sure how that's pronounced, when a family moves into a new house, a priest collects the souls of the whole family in a bag and afterwards restores them to their owners, because the moment of entering a new house is supposed to be fraught with supernatural danger. In the south of the same land, when a woman is brought to bed, the messenger who fetches the doctor or the midwife always carries with him something made of iron, such as a chopping knife, which he delivers to the doctor. The doctor must keep the thing in his house until the confinement is over, when he gives it back, receiving a fixed sum of money. The chopping knife, or whatever the iron object is, represents the woman's soul, which at this critical time is believed to be safer out of the body than in it. Among the Dayaks of Pinoe, something in southeastern Borneo, when a child is born, a medicine man is sent for who conjures the soul of the infant into half a coconut, which he thereupon covers with a cloth and places on a square platter or charger suspended by cords from the roof. He repeats this at every new moon for a year. In the Kei Islands in the Indian archipelago, when there's a newly born child in the house, an empty coconut is split and spliced together again, and the soul of the infant is believed to be temporarily deposited in the coconut in order that it may be safe from the attacks of evil spirits. But when the child grows bigger and stronger, the soul will take up its permanent abode in its own body. Similarly, among the Eskimo of Alaska, when a child is sick, the medicine man will sometimes extract its soul from its body and place it for safekeeping in an amulet, which for further security he deposits in his own medicine bag, and again for many different variants along the same thing. For example, in other cases, the life or the soul of people is felt to be bound up with a tree. So, for example, among the Mbengas of Western Africa, when two children are born on the same day, the people plant two trees of the same kind and dance around them. The life of each of the children is believed to be bound up with the life of one of the trees, and if the tree dies or is thrown down, they are sure that the child will soon die. Same thing, many other stories. And it is said that there are still custom is still followed by families in Russia, Germany, England, France and Italy, who plant a tree at the birth of a child. And he gives examples of the same customs, for example, near the castle of Dalhousie, not far from Edinburgh. There grows an oak tree called the Edgewell tree, which is popularly believed to be linked to the fate of the family by a mysterious tie, for they say that when one of the family dies or is about to die, a branch falls from the Edgewell tree. Thus, on seeing a great bough drop from the tree on a quiet still day in July 1874, an old forester exclaimed, "Oh, the Lord's dead now." And soon after, news came that Fox Maule, 11th Earl of Dalhousie, was dead. Okay, so these very common belief right throughout the ancient world. And this is what the sutta is talking about in the Natalakama Sutta, where it talks about having a self which is external or internal, okay, made of form or not of form. You're talking precisely about these kinds of beliefs, that one believes that oneself or one's soul is bound up in some external object. So this is obviously a very primitive idea, very widespread idea, found in all kinds of cultures, through all different strata of societies, through humanity. Now there's a few interesting points here. One point is that the tale sort of riffs satirically on that idea. Okay, so the tale itself is sophisticated enough to already be regarding this kind of idea of an external folk thing, as being a slightly silly superstition, which is worth nothing more than to be a bit of the object of a joke. And even a stupid crocodile should know better than that. Yeah. So the tale itself, although from our point of view, it seems like it's fairly, quite a simple tale, actually is already quite knowing and quite ironical in its presentation of these ideas. Okay, it's not presenting from within the ideas, it's not assuming that these ideas, like an external soul, are true, but it's adopting a satirical, ironical stance regarding them, which I think is quite interesting and quite characteristic of the Jatakas as a class of literature. It's very important to understand this, that the Jatakas are compiled maybe 200 BC, okay? And we're already, in these very old stories, finding this kind of questioning attitude towards these ideas. And of course, it's brought up much more explicitly in many other cases. So maybe we should move on to another little story and see what we can learn from that. So if we go to another one of the low versions of the story, this would be Jataka 292, the story of the okay, so Patta. Okay, so this one is an interesting one. The background story, so if anyone's interested to look at the Pali text, I'm looking at the Tripitaka, VRI Tripitaka site here to get these, and we pass on a research institute. And it's the Goenka people, and so they've got the Tripitaka with the commentary. So that's the only place I know of online you can get the Jataka text under the commentary. 292. The Jataka numbers are here in the square brackets. Okay, so here's the origin story. So that's the background. The story in this life is told here in this paragraph. This story, the master told Jetavana about a meal of rice mixed with new ghee with red fish to flavour it, which was given by Venerable Sariputta to Bimbadevi. Okay, Bimbadevi, of course, the Bodhisattva's, the Buddha's former wife, Yashoda, usually called Bimbadevi or Rahula Mata in these texts. The circumstances are like those given above in the Abhantara birth tale, Abhantara Jataka, which we'll read a little bit later. Here too, the holy sister had a pain in the stomach. The excellent Rahula said to the elder Sariputta, Sariputta seated Rahula in his waiting room and went to the king to get the rice, red fish, and new ghee. The lad Rahula gave it to the holy sister, his mother. No sooner had she eaten it than the pain subsided. The king sent messengers to make inquiries, and after that, always sent her that kind of food. One day they began to talk about it in the Hall of Truth. Friend, the captain of the faith satisfied the sister with such and such food. The Buddha came in and asked what they were talking about. They told him. He said, "This is not the first time that Sariputta has given Rahula's mother what she wanted. He did the same before." So saying, he told an old world tale. So this is an interesting background story told about the Buddha's former wife. And again, we find that kind of ethical ambiguity. In the one sense, it seems like we've got the same dynamic going on, don't we? You know, here's the woman lying in bed, oh, I'm hurting so much, you need to get these special things for me. And the monk running around, having to go to the king to get these special fine foods to satisfy her wishes. So that's one way that you could read the story. On the other hand, we know that the Buddha's former wife, Yashodhara, or Bimbadevi, was commonly regarded as an arahant. And so it would be assumed that if she said that she needed that, that it was because she really did need it, and not because she was acting out of her own desire. So this particular story is quite ambiguous in that way. But again, I'm sure you can recognise the similarity here between this and the overall motif that we're talking about. So now, having gone from a relatively realistic event in the life of the Buddha, or presented as being in the life of the Buddha, we're now going back into the mythological age. Once upon a time, when Brahmadatta was king in Benares, the Bodhisattva was born as a crow. He grew up. So the word for crow in Pali is gaka. For fairly obvious reasons. He grew up and became... And the Bodhisattva became the chief of 80,000 crows, a crow king by the name of Supatta, or Fairwing. And his chief mate went by the name of Supasa, or Softy, his chief captain. Supasa, literally soft touch. Her chief captain was called Sumuko, Pretty Beak. And with his 80,000 subjects, he dwelt close by Benares. One day, the king and his mate, in search of food, passed over the king's kitchen. The king's cook had been preparing a host of dishes of all sorts of fish, and he'd uncovered the dishes for a moment to cool them. The queen crow smelt the odour of the food and longed for a bit, but that day she said nothing. However, the next day, when the king crow proposed that they should go feeding, she said, "Go by yourself, there's something I want very much." "What is it?" said he. "I want some of the king's food to eat, and as I can't get it, I will die." Yeah? Alright, so here's the... That's my jivatanga. I will die, I will give up my life. And here's the word dohala again. This is very important. What kind of dohala do you have? I will... Where are we? The crow set to think. Pretty Beak approached him, remembering Pretty Beak is Sariputta, approached him and asked if anything had displeased him. The king crow told him what had happened. "Oh, that'll be all right," said the captain, and added to console them both, "You stay where you are today and I'll fetch the meat." So he gathered the crows together and told the matter. "Now come, let's get it," said he, and off they all flew together to Benares. He posted them in companies here and there near the kitchen to watch, and he, with eight champions, sat on the kitchen roof, waiting for the king's food to be served. He gave his directions to these. "When the food is taken up, I'll make the man drop the dishes. Once that's done, there's an end of me. So four of you must fill your mouths with the rice and four with the fish and feed a royal pair with them. And if they ask where I am, say, I'm coming." The cook got his various dishes already, hung them on a balance pole and went off towards the king's rooms. As he passed through the court, the crow captain, with a signal to his followers, flew and settled upon the carrier's chest, struck him with extended claws with his beak, sharp as a spear point. He pecked the end of the man's nose and with his two feet stopped up his jaws. The king was walking up and down on an upper floor, and looking out of a large window, he saw what the crow was doing. He called the carrier, "Oi, you, down with the dishes, go, put down the dishes and catch the crow." So the man dropped the dishes and caught the crow tight. "Come here," said the king. Then the crows ate all they wanted, picked up the rest as they'd been told, and carried it off. Next, the others all flocked up and ate what remained. The eight champions gave it to their king and queen to eat, and the craving of Softy was appeased. The king, the servant who was carrying the dinner, brought his crow to the king. "O crow," said the king, "you have shown no respect for me. You have broken my servant's nose, you've smashed my dishes, you've recklessly thrown away your old life. What on earth made you do such things?" The crow said, "O great king, our king lives near Benares, and I am the captain of his forces. His wife, Softy, conceived a great longing and wanted a taste of your food. A king told me what she craved, and at once I devoted my life. Now I have sent her the food. My desire is accomplished. This is the reason why I acted as I did. And to explain the matter, he said, here in Benares, and so this is the verses. So always in the Jatakas, the climax of it is the verses. Here in Benares city, O great king, there dwells a king of crows that hight Fair Wing, who was attended by a following of 80,000 crows. Softy, his mate, had one o'ermastering wish. She craved a supper of the king's own fish, fresh caught, cooked in his kitchen, such a dish as to the king's tables goes. You now behold me as their royal messenger. It was my royal master sent me here, and for that I my monarch do revere. I wounded that man's nose. When the king heard this, he said, we do great honour to men, and yet cannot make friends of them. Even though we make presents of such things as a whole village, we can't find anyone willing to give his life for us. But this creature, even though he's a crow, sacrifices his own life for his king. He is very noble, sweet-speaking and good. He was so pleased with the crow's good qualities that he did him the honour of giving him a white umbrella as a symbol of royalty. But the crow saluted the king with this, his own gift, and preached about the virtues of Fairwing, his own king. The king sent for the crow king, the Bodhisattva, and heard his teachings, and sent them both food of the same sort as he ate himself. And for the rest of the crows, he had cooked each day a large measure of rice. He himself lived according to the admonition of the Bodhisattva, and protecting all creatures, practiced virtue. The admonitions of Fairwing the crow were remembered for 700 years. And when the master had ended this discourse, he identified the birth. At that time, the king was Ananda, the captain was Sariputta, but Supatta, the king of crows, was I myself. It doesn't actually say that. Yeah, you're right. Maybe just an oversight. The way that the identifications are done at the end is not always consistent, and so on. But certainly seems very that was the intention, that Bimba Devi be the her at the end. Yeah. King was Ananda, Sariputta. Oh no, that's just a translation error. Here we go, Supatta Rahulamata. It's an error of the translator. It says that the king, queen Supatta was Rahula's mother. Yeah. Might have been either a mistake of the translator or perhaps a flaw in the text he was using, the manuscript he was using.
But that's another example of how the unconscious biases of the translator.
Well, not without precedent. So, what do we have to say about that little story yet? What does that tell us? Have we learned anything new?
Firstly, that the motive of the irrational desires of the women in both of these stories stand for what occurs to a person when they go forth out of faith.
Uh-huh.
There's this deep, visceral kind of desire that first they describe to themselves or to other people why they want to go forth. It's at the behest of that that all the rationality, that all the practice, that everything that we do actually comes together. And actually, when that falls away, that's when we're most in danger. It's when our faith falls away. Our mythic sense of faith, the irrational sense of faith, when that falls away, then when things go wrong from day to day, things don't make sense to us.
Very true. Yeah, and it tells us, that's in our particular context, but I think also more generally about desire, There's something about it because we don't understand our own desires. So what's different about this story compared to the other one?
Seems to be a lot more goodwill in this story.
Mm-hmm.
The king was very nice.
Yeah, wasn't he? Yeah. It would have been very easy for him to just say, kill the crow and stuff.
That's what I was expecting. Because it seems to follow on from other stories. Most of the folk tales are pretty rough.
Yeah, pretty rough and ready. Yeah. No, that's definitely one of the general characteristics of the Jatakas, that they tend to gentle things. Yeah.
I don't know why all this origin wind me up the Chinese. The wise king is able to recognize the and faith to one's master.
Yeah, yeah.
That they are willing to give their life. These are the types of people that a king should have by their side.
Mm.
And he's wise enough to recognize this strength in this person. It is like for us interacting by the phone. We don't just judge by the action.
Yeah.
We have to see what is behind that action to know whether the person is acting out of foolishness or something else.
Yeah.
Yes. So it takes a very wise person to be able to recognize these and be forgiving and
to inquire before passing judgment. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is something that again is mentioned again and again throughout the Jatakas, is the need to make inquiries before passing judgment.
Yeah. Something I like about the stories is that crows, I mean the way that people stories, it's so difficult the way the crows behave, and they're very, very clever animals.
Uh-huh.
So the person you talk about who wrote this story appreciates crows.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because they're close to nature and observe the animals and stuff.
Yeah.
Folk wisdom.
Not just have an animal that's picked at random from a group of animals. It's somebody who has observed
carefully. Yeah, but I think there's also like the almost the surprise element of that as well, isn't there? That even though crows are kind of an ugly animal, it's usually regarded as not particularly auspicious or anything.
I don't know,
European folk tales, the crow is usually a very wise animal. Uh-huh.
So people recognise that they're very clever.
Clever
but not noble.
Yeah.
Not noble,
maybe
not.
Yeah, kind of a different kind of quality.
I think
there's another, I think I mentioned this before, there's another Jataka where they actually talk about trading, the only Jataka where some land, where Babylon is mentioned, and they send a ship down to Babylon, and they have a crow on the ship, and when the Babylonians have never seen a crow, so they say, "Oh, we'll pay you so much for this crow." So the Indians are really happy, and this crow becomes the sensation in the whole of Babylon. They've never seen anything like this before, and they make big exhibitions, and everyone comes to see it, and so on. And the next time the trading ship comes, they bring a peacock. Right. And crow is completely blown out of the water. and of course the whole thing of they do all the negotiations because they've got this crow and they say, "Oh, how much are we going to pay for, can we buy it for?" And the Indians are saying, "Oh, this is a very rare and precious bird, we can't really part from it, you know. Oh, look, we'll be willing to pay anything. Oh, really, it's too much for us to be able to part with this." But has such noble black colour.
Mm.
The beak is so pointy.
And they seem to have a teamwork.
Yes,
very much. Birds flocking together, yeah. The thing to me, the most important difference with this one is that it succeeds, yeah? In the past one it fails, and this one she succeeds in her wish. There's a few different reasons why she succeeds. Well, there's a number of differences. One is that what she wants is not as bad, right? She doesn't want to kill anything. She just wants to nick a bit of food from the royal kitchen. I'm sure that they'd get by without it. But even though Sariputta's willing to sacrifice his life, in fact, he's okay. And it's at that moment of that truly heroic act where he will really give himself up in faith. Now, of course, if it had happened to be Devadatta who'd been born as the king of the human king, then he would have been finished. But luckily enough, he was a Nanda, so he was okay. And not only, but the thing that's really critical about this one is that she gets what she wants, right? Which was, in a sense, a very limited and that very irrational desire. But the actual result of that is far greater than anything that she actually wanted in the beginning. Okay, the king declares an amnesty for the crows. Does he do an amnesty here? The king listened to his teaching and he protected all creatures. Okay, after this. And this is very, very important. So he declares an amnesty. So the result of her irrational wish, yeah, carried out by the men, her desire, men carry it out, and the result of that is peace and safety for all. Yeah? Abundance and life is granted to the whole realm because of that. Definitely very appropriate.
Perhaps this is, as Jason suggested, more about desire for faith in Dharma.
That's something which comes out much more explicitly in some of the higher forms of this particular story. Yeah. And again, just to remark that with all of these stories, it's the woman's desire which is the creative force. She underlies the story wouldn't exist. This whole world which has been captured in that story wouldn't exist if it wasn't for her desire. Yeah? And she's created the existence of that world and has enabled that to give rise to abundance and to life, has transformed that. So
that might reflect the core of a woman's desire, to multiply, to have
for life.
I mean, that's certainly something that the woman really doesn't have control of. And that not having control of it might be part of what they're getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
and it's also something that men can have, which might be also a root of the fear, that reproductive capacity.
And the fear of loss of control?
No, the fear of, well, but men haven't got that reproductive capacity and they can't have
it. In those senses, like the male fear is feminine and arise without the loss of control in the sense that they can't have it.
But the thing is, that is part of the feminine. I mean, you can sort of own I'm not quite sure what people mean by, I mean, I haven't read all these psychology books and things, what they mean by, owning your femininity and all this sort of stuff. But, there are characteristics that have been labelled as feminine, and characteristics that have been labelled as masculine, but when it comes down to it, on the biological side, women have babies, men have another function in the reproductive cycle, and
so you can stand there and everything be.
No. I suppose nurturing the life, the new life, is what women do, and men don't do, or can't do, because from a biological point of view, biological necessity, and so I'm not a man, I don't know how men feel about that, but that might be sort of, this sort of mysterious thing of giving birth is something men seem to fear over. I don't know about nowadays, but a lot of these stories may, and then the mythology and the misogyny that's developed, maybe it's got something to do with that. I don't know.
Just to remark just very briefly on the question about the the topic of masculine and feminine qualities in psychology. As I understand it, it's the way it's treated in psychology, and especially in Jungian psychology, is it's quite a different question from the question of, say, what is biologically determined or what is socially determined and so on. It simply means what is actually conceived by people or seen by people as having those kinds of qualities. Whether that's actually a justified or reasonable or universal way of saying it is a separate question. I mean, that's a question for a feminist critique. But the psychological analysis is just seeing how people do in fact conceive these things within their minds.
Which is quite culturally conditioned.
And that's then the question, to what extent is it culturally conditioned or biologically and so on. Yeah.
And of course, the cultural conditioning will vary the boundary lines, but the value predominantly of the idea of the union between the masculine and the feminine, archetypally within culture and the individual, is just the idea that there are two different perspectives, at least two different perspectives on everything, and they're not necessarily easily seeable at the same time. And so it's good to, if you look at the yin, to also look at the yang. So if you look at the masculine, you also look at the feminine. If you look at the up, you also look at the down.
Can you also understand the concept of yin and yang? Is that necessarily
masculine and feminine? Yes, so what I'm saying is that all it is about broadening horizons. Always giving oneself
well,
the opportunity to broaden horizons.
Yeah, is that what you mean? By being open to all perspectives or
we could go on.
No,
to me, gender is all about power.
Okay. Yeah.
The thing is that I hear people sort of talking about this in terms of gender or femininity or masculinity, and everybody comes from a different perspective, and it's very difficult to understand things in a different way.
Okay, so let's move on for this morning. We'll just look at one more story, and this is the third of the low forms of the story. And this is the story of the jackal longing for redfish we also featured in the previous one, and we also have the dohala, and the jackal succeeds in this one by means of a trick. So this is redfish and jackal number 400. Dabhapu pajataka varnana. Okay. The Buddha told this story while dwelling in Jetavana concerning Upananda of the Sakyan tribe. Upananda was ordained in the faith but forsook the virtues of contentment and the rest and became very greedy. At the beginning of the rains, he tried two or three monasteries, leaving at one an umbrella or a shoe, at one a walking stick or a water pot, and dwelling in one himself. Okay, so keeping his dibs on different kutis in different places. He began the rains in a country monastery and thinking, the bhikkhus should live contentedly. Explained to the bhikkhus as if he was making the moon rise in the sky, the way to the noble state of contentment, praising contentment with the requisites. Hearing him, the bhikkhus threw away their pleasant robes and vessels, took pots of clay and robes of dust rags. He then collected those nice robes and vessels, put them in his own lodging. And... when the rain when the it's great open up he's chanting. When the rains in Pavarana were over, he filled up a cart with all his requisites and went to Jetavana. On the way, behind a monastery in the forest, wrapping his feet with creepers, he said, surely something can be got here. He entered the monastery. I'm not sure what this thing, wrapping his feet with creepers, maybe he's trying to pretend that he's very poor and doesn't have shoes or something. Two old brethren had spent the rains there. They had two coarse cloaks and one fine blanket, and as they couldn't divide them, they were pleased to see him, thinking, this elder will divide these between us. And they said, sir, we cannot divide this, which is our garment for the rains. We have a dispute about it. Can you divide it between us? Upananda consented, and giving the two coarse cloaks back to them, he took the fine blanket, thinking, saying, "This one comes to me because I know the Vinaya." And he went away. These elders, who were attached to the fine blanket, went with him to the Jetavan and told the matter to the bhikkhus, who knew the Vinaya, saying, "Is this right for one who knows the Vinaya to devour plunder thus?" The bhikkhus, seeing the pile of robes and bowls brought by the Venerable Upananda, said, "Sir, you have great merit. You have gained much food and clothes." He said, "Sirs, where is my merit? I gained this in such and such a manner, telling them all." Okay, so in other words, he's saying, "I didn't get these because of my merit, I got it because of my trickery." And then in the Dhamma hall, they sat around complaining about Upananda. He's very covetous and greedy. The master listened to them and said, Upananda's deeds are not suited for progress. When a brother explains progress to another, he should first act suitably himself and then preach to others. And so that's the kind of the moral of the story in this case. And then he told a tale of the past. Now, once upon a time, so here's the beginning of the tale of the past. Adide means in the past. Brahmadatta was reigning in Benares as usual. The Bodhisattva was a tree spirit by a riverbank, a jackal named Mayavi, because Mayavi meaning the deluder, had taken a wife and lived in a place by that riverbank. One day his mate said to him, "Husband, a longing has come upon me. I desire to eat a fresh rohita fish, a fresh blood fish or red fish." So dohala, dohalo upanno. Okay. He said, "Take it easy. I will bring it to you." And going by the river, he wrapped his feet in creepers and went along the bank. Okay, wrapping his feet in creepers as a jackal, just like Upananda did as a bhikkhu, went along the bank. At that moment, two otters called Gambhirachari and Anudhirachari. So these are the Gambhirachari means the profound wanderer, or wanderer of the deep, and Anudhirachari meaning the wandering along the shore, one who wanders along the shore. Okay, Dwe Udda. Okay, so here's the word otter, which in Pali is Udda, of course being the same word. So the English word otter ultimately derived from the Pali Udda, and that being related to the word Uddaka, meaning water. So otter meaning water creature.
I wonder if that still happens.
I wouldn't be surprised. So Gambhirachari, the wanderer of the deeps, they were standing on the bank looking for fish. The wanderer of the deeps saw a great rohita fish, great red fish, and entered the water with a bound. What does it mean? With a tie or something. He took it by the tail. The fish was strong and went away dragging him. He called to the other, "This great fish will be enough for both of us. Come and help me." And then he said the first verse. "My friend, Anudhirachari, the wanderer along the shore, rush to my aid, I pray. I've caught a great fish, but by force he's carrying me away." Now then the two together took out the... hearing him, the other spoke the second stanza. "Oh, wanderer of the deeps, good luck to you. Your lift is be firm and stout, and as a rock would, as a Garuda would lift a snake, I'll lift the fellow out." Okay, so it's referring to the mythic idea of the Garudas who would always pick up the snakes, the nagas. Then the two together took out the redfish, laid him upon the ground and killed him. But saying each to the other, "You divide him," they quarrelled and could not divide him. And so they sat down, leaving him. At that moment the jackal came to the spot. Seeing him, they both saluted the jackal and said, "Lord of the grey grass colour." Of course, this being very satirical, the jackal is always depicted as being the most, you know, low and foul creatures in the Jatakas. "This fish was taken by both of us together. A dispute arose because we could not divide him. Please make an equal division and divide it among us." And he spoke the third stanza. "A strife has arisen between us. Mark, O thou of grassy hue." Okay, this is a Dabdha Pupa of the title. let our contention, honoured sir, be settled fair by you. All right, so this idea of calling the jackal the Dabba Pupa, which is the title of the Jataka, is obviously just highly satirical, and it's basically their way of greasing up the jackal. The jackal heard them and declared his own strength. "I have arbitrated many a case and done it peacefully. Let your contention, honoured sirs, be settled fair by me." Right. Having spoken that stanza and making the division, he spoke this stanza. "Anuttirachari, you get the tail. Gambhirachari, you get the head. And the rest of the fish will go to the judge." Okay? Exactly, yeah. This absolutely is a precedent for the whole legal system. Yeah, right. Of course, yes. All right, so having divided the fish, he said, "You have the head and the tail without quarrelling," and then seizing the middle portion in his mouth, he ran away before their eyes. They stand downcast, as if they'd lost 1,000 pieces of money, and spoke the sixth stanza. "But for our strife, it would have long sufficed us without fail. But now the jackal takes the fish and leaves us head and tail." The jackal was pleased, and thinking, "Now I will give my wife the red fish to eat," he went to her. She saw him coming, and saluting him, spoke a stanza. "Even as a king is glad to join a kingdom to his rule, so I'm glad to see my lord today with his mouth full." Then she asked him about how he got it, speaking a verse. "How, being of the land, have you from water caught a fish? And how did you do the feat, my lord? Pray answer to my wish." The jackal, explaining the means to her, spoke the next stanza. "By strife it is their weakness comes, by strife their means decay. By strife the otters lost their prize. Mayavi, eat the prey." And then there's another stanza uttered by the perfect wisdom of the Buddha. So this is added by the Buddha at the end. "Even so, when strife arises among men, they seek an arbiter. He's the leader then. Their wealth decays and the king's coffers gain." Yeah? A bit of acute worldly wisdom there. After the lesson, the master declared the truths and identified the bird. And so, I mean, that's a classic example of what you're talking earlier, Jackie, about the subversiveness of things. You know, it's actually the king who wins that, all these things. After the lesson, the master declared the truths and identified the birth. At that time, the jackal was Upananda. The otters were the two old men, which is the two monks who got conned out of their robes. And the tree spirit who witnessed the event was myself. Okay, so the Bodhisattva didn't play... this happens occasionally in the Jatakas. The Bodhisattva is not an actual participant, but he's said to be a deva or something who just watches the events as they happen. In that particular one, it's difficult to know. There wasn't really a hero who the Bodhisattva could be identifying with in the story. None of them particularly impressive. Yeah. Very, very subversive little tale. How's it doing that here?
Well, by creating strife, then you end up with that. Or by falling to forces that create strife, you end up being much worse than you have.
Except in this case, it's the men who are striking, not the women.
Oh, yeah, so I mean, that's different.
I don't argue with the world, isn't it? Well, it argues, isn't it? Yeah. So here we see this is like another pitching of the tale. You know, again in this one, it succeeds, right? But the interesting thing is that in the one we saw before with the crows, it succeeded by means of heroism, self-sacrifice, and ultimately of compassion. Yeah? And the outcome of that was abundance and life for all. Yeah? Now this one succeeded merely by trickery. Yeah? It's a lower level of tale, it's cunning. This is more the kind of Odyssean kind of level of mythology. Yeah? It's no great self-sacrifice or anything, it's just a trick. So, and the outcome of that, well, yes, she gets what she wants, but that's all. Yeah, so it doesn't lead to any greater benefits.
The king grunting and his teeth just crows.
To all the animals, yeah.
But then the fishes need to be sacrificed for the crows' meat. There's another type of life that is being.
That's getting a little bit too specific. Yeah, kind of overinterpreting it. Yeah. You know, it's more like a motif. I mean, it says that they kept the five precepts and that teaching lasted for 700 years. So like 700 is obviously a mythic time frame. And so, you know, it's just the idea that that's the abundance that come from it. I mean, the practical implications, obviously. Yeah.
You reminds me of something that somebody said that, you know, those animal lovers who say, you know, we must protect this animal and all that, but they will eat other animals. So, the animal is compassion. Yeah. It's getting too far.
So, I'm also reminding you of a motif in one of Neil Gaiman's book, The Nazi Boys, where there's this movement in mythology from very savage kind of stories, and basically the moral is that you need to be savage to. To get by and win, then there's like a tiger kind of lion story, then it moves up into the spider slash monkey story, where you get by by trickery, so that's the Odyssean story, and then there's another movement in mythology that raises above that, which is probably your higher level, where it's compassion. In Greek mythology
that's more associated with Theseus. He's the legendary hero of Athens. So he's the sort of the champion of democracy and the people and so on.
When what do you think of the just representation of karma, that as if everything is so linear, and that kind of just in almost present things in a very literal sense. If I see this person last night, he was a monkey, this night he was my monk. That kind of presentation go on again and again in the Jataka. What do you think, what kind of implications does it have?
Yeah, that's a very good point, and I think that, you know, I think in a way it's very simplistic. You know, that certainly that there are, you know, if we accept the idea of rebirth, then certainly there's going to be, you know, associations and tendencies that go on. And it's also no doubt that they're very tenacious, like we can see from people from when they're young children, even babies in the womb, and they have certain characteristics, personality characteristics, which they then keep with them their whole life. You know, so these things do last a long time. So I don't think there's any problem with assuming that there are similar patterns of behaviour which we tend to play out again and again and again. We can certainly see that in our own lives. But yes, as you say, that they do tend to be presented in a quite a literal way. But that's more just a didactic device. It's just a story, a teaching device and storytelling device. You know, you can well imagine that you know, in the case like this, you know, originally you have an event, and then somebody knows it. So you know, maybe that event with Ananda happened, or maybe it didn't. But it's quite a plausible kind of event that may well have happened in the Sangha. Yeah, and so some teacher may well have responded to that event by telling this folk tale which they all knew about, yeah? And that's a way of commenting on the story, you know, and so on. And then when it gets put into the literary form later on, the connections get drawn, and that's where it becomes more kind of doctrinal. So that aspect of it isn't really, I don't think it's really essential to the storytelling. It's more just kind of tacked on to sort of put it into the whole literary framework. Yeah. But certainly I think it's very important that we be aware of that and not to be trapped into too much literalism interpreting them. Especially the idea that you're somehow trapped by what's happened in past lives or something that's like making you act in that way in this life. I think that's a very dangerous idea.
You talked about the outcome.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that the outcome is not at all connected to the wish. Mm-hmm. The wish in this one and the wish in the previous one, it's just food.
It's just food, isn't that fair?
But the outcome is actually the result of the person that they came against. It's another the king.
Yeah.
His reaction is compassion to the wish, whereas the reaction of these people to the wish is. So it's nothing to do with the wish itself, but the person who lot of it's the story that runs the reaction to it.
Yeah, although that's true, and it's certainly true in terms of the ones we've looked at so far, and in terms of the surface narrative, but it may well be the case that there are also subconscious forces underlying the wish. You see, the very fact that the wish is irrational suggests that there's something going on which is underlying it, and that's actually brought out more explicitly in some of the others, where she is actually quite conscious of what she wants, although nobody else is. But we'll see some examples of that later on.
So there's a different lower level to the wish.
Yeah.
And also, if you go back to the table, what I'm intrigued is the one that you didn't mark as Corona, because the whole battle is the irrational wish of women. So what's the story? What's the triumph of the ones that are.
That don't have dohala.
Yeah.
They're basically the same story. They just don't happen to use that exact word. That's all. Yeah. So, but when we look at them, you'll see that it's clearly the same story. Yeah. It's just the terminology is a bit different. Yeah.
Another, I think,
what
I'd like to say the jackals and the otters.
Yeah.
Behavior. So difficult. I mean, that's the sort of thing that you could observe in nature. It's just sort of, for me, it's quite lovely that they can hear the conceived the story. So probably had a really keen powers of observation.
Yeah. And you know.
If you see jackals, you see that type of wild dogs.
Yeah.
Do that all the time. It's never. And they get addicted, and they go, and people.
And it's interesting that's observed again on this is on a very kind of like an animal level. But exactly the same story also happens on the highest levels. I mean, in Greek mythology, that's the story of Prometheus, and Prometheus tricked the gods because he offered a sacrifice, and he got the skin of the animal and wrapped up the skin with the bones and the guts. And then to make it look like it was the meat, and then burnt it to offer as a sacrifice for the gods. And Zeus came down and ate it, took it, accepted the sacrifice, and only afterwards realized he'd been tricked by Prometheus. Yeah? So Prometheus did that on behalf of mankind, so that the people could offer just all the guts and the bones and stuff from the sacrifice in the future, and they would take the meat to eat for themselves. Yeah? So for that, Prometheus got chained to the mountainside and kind of nailed there, and had vultures eating or eagles eating his guts out and so on. So that was his punishment. But similar, and you actually find the same story in the Jatakas as well, where the gods are tricked as to the nature of the sacrifice, yeah, and they get the bad stuff.
The purpose of all these Jataka stories is to depict the desires of women. The author's trying to tell us that we should look at ourselves from the perspective that the female wish is actually our own desires, and then how the other part of the story was carried out is actually the manifestation of our mental volition and all those things following, out of what it will become because of the initial desire.
It's a bit hard to say. I mean, I think these are. It's very hard to say what's the intention of the people who are writing the story. It seems to me that the overt moral of most of these stories, okay, so far, say this one is basically contentment. Yeah, it seems to be pretty clear with the story of Upananda and so on. That basically the moral that they're trying to give across is that you should be content. And not have too many desires. But it also seems to me that there are these underlying implications and so on, which are telling another different kind of story. So this is sometimes what happens is that there are certain kinds of truth which are not so easily expressed in a very explicit and rational way. And so those kinds of truth are also part of what the story is doing. So there's a guy parking out there and flushing his...
I see.
Very interesting.
Well, it's a good thing he's got those flashing lights there. So keep him safe in the passing traffic. Okay. All right. Yeah, but again, we'll see this as we see the different unfoldings of the different tale and how they work out in different contexts. All right. So maybe that's enough for this morning. We'll resume next week, and we'll have a look next week at the medium tales. We have three medium ones here. Maybe one. Probably that's enough for next week. Maybe one of the high forms. So again, I mean, this idea of low, medium, high, it's just a very rough. I mean, you could see with the story of the Crow Queen, in a sense, that could have been regarded as a high form of the myth because the result of it was abundance and compassion and prosperity. So in that sense, it was quite a high form. But in terms of the characters who were playing and the actual action of the thing, it was quite a low form. So it's a bit arbitrary.
Well, maybe it's not arbitrary in the sense that what you're labelling there is the surface.
Yeah.
Actually, what you get out of
the
interview. Yeah. So if you decide to trigger on it, it was a high story. Mm. Yeah.
So
are we having
much of a process on Tuesday?
Should be. Normally, we'll be Tuesdays at 4 o'clock. What's happening next week? Next week, you're going to Canberra. Yeah, so this is the normal event, which serves a very distinctive purpose as being an assumption from which we can deviate. So next week, that we have Wednesday, nothing much is happening on Wednesday, which is good. So maybe we'll... Look, we might end up... Well, what about Monday? Maybe
Monday.
Wednesday morning. Monday is a possibility, Tuesday the ladies are going, and Wednesday would have to be the community meeting if we're going to have it in
person. Wednesday's Monday's the opposite.
We have to go until 9.
So we can have community meeting on Tuesday?
Could
it
take longer than that?
Yeah.
The community meeting Tuesday?
Yeah.
Yeah? We could do this at a constantly positive, don't we?
Monday, I think Ramananda was actually planning to start that study for the She wants to finish it before she leaves.
Yeah.
She was thinking about Monday and the next Thursday before she leaves.
Okay.
But anyway, she has to finish it.
Okay. Look, maybe. I don't like to do a class on the same day as I'm doing a talk. I've kind of run out of things to say. maybe some might consider a blessing. I don't know. But in any case, I feel a bit foolish. So let's try for the Monday, and we'll talk to Ayananda and see if she can swap that around or something like that. Would that be okay? It's just for next week. It is a bit crowded with things. So. Let's tentatively put it on Monday at about 4 o'clock. Okay, we can maybe do the opposita straight after the dana or something like we were doing in the masa. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects. Actually, just before we break up, just one or two points just for your information. Okay. You know that they're having the meeting in Wat Bakong on Sunday. Which is when we're having our katina. So we should actually check the time zone. It's actually 3 o'clock. We'll check actually what time it is. But so we can maybe give a special dedication and blessing of support for Ajahn Brahm as he enters the lion's den. And alone, as I'm safely here, surrounded by lots of wonderful supportive people. Oh, absolutely. Yes, right. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So that's on Sunday. Now, a little tidbit of info et that I got last night from Jitindria. Apparently the remaining one of the 5 points which we hadn't heard is that Ajahn Sumedho must personally perform or authorise all Sila Dhara ordinations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So again, just completely against the veneer to make ordination dependent on a particular person, but that's apparently unconfirmed. That's what Jitendra said. So the 5 points are that the nuns have to go behind the monks in everything. There's a liaison monk to communicate between the monks and nuns. The nuns have to ask for admonition from the monks at the end of the rains retreat. Mm-hmm. Ajahn Sumedho personally appoints the ordination.
Please,
yeah. And that the Siladhara platform is not a stepping stone to bhikkhuni ordination. So as far as we're aware, that's what the 5 points are. And we'll try to figure out more about them later.